A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll hear about how a local holiday service has become an international season tradition, as well as its broader impact on the musical world. King's College Cambridge's Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols is marking its 100th anniversary this year, and I'll speak about this history with Director of Music Stephen Cleberry, who is retiring next September after 37 years. I'll also talk with Westminster Choir College professor James Jordan, who helped launch that school's now traditional Evening of Readings and Carols for the Princeton community. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Raven Wilkinson, who became the first African-American dancer to work with a major ballet troupe, has passed away at the age of 83. According to the blog Slip Disc, which first reported her death, she was hired by the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo in 1955 and danced with them for 6 years, but was then turned down by the New York City Ballet, American Ballet Theater, and Metropolitan Opera Ballet. According to her obituary in the New York Times, Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo frequently toured in the segregated South, but she refused to hide her race by wearing light makeup. She eventually left the company and stopped dancing, but in 1967 joined the Dutch National Ballet. In 1974, after returning to the U.S., she danced with the New York City Opera until it closed in 2011. That's just some of the news this week from around the arts world. For some, it wouldn't be Christmas Eve without turning on the radio and listening to the annual broadcast of a Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols from King's College Cambridge. The service has been held at the college since 1918, adapted from a format drawn up by a future Archbishop of Canterbury about 40 years earlier. Over the years, it has evolved to include newly commissioned works and attracted a worldwide following through radio broadcasts and most recently, live streaming. This year, King's College Cambridge Director of Music Stephen Cleberry will lead the choir for the 37th time, his final festival before he retires next September. You just heard an excerpt from the traditional opening of the festival, once in Royal David City, performed by the choir of King's College Cambridge and conducted by Cleberry. I spoke with him this week about his experience with the festival, its evolution, and its impact on the broader choral world.
I think that when the service was devised in 1918 by the then Dean of King's, Eric Milner White, he had in mind two or three things, the principal of which was that he wanted to devise a service for Christmas that he felt might be more relevant and interesting for people. And that, I think, wish that grew out of his experience as a padre in the British Army during the war, which had just ended. And I think it was conceived also in the original words as a gift to the city of Cambridge. And of course, eventually that's effectively turned into a gift to the world, because since those days, we've had the advent of the BBC in 1928, and then things like the BBC World Service. And for the last 40 years or so, of course, it's been broadcast on American public radio. And now we have the internet. And so it has become a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, the concept of a festival of nine carols dates back to roughly 1878. There were a few early predecessors. What made the Cambridge adaptation different and unique?
I think probably that began in 1928 when it began to be broadcast on an annual basis by the BBC.
As you mentioned, it's become well known in and of itself, but there also are other forms of festivals of lessons and carols that have taken root in other communities. What type of example do you think the Cambridge version set in terms of showing what a Christmas service could be?
I think the origins of it for me are possibly monastic. That's to say, the number nine is quite interesting, because in the monastic matins, if I recall correctly, they had three sets of three lessons, that's to say nine, and each of these lessons would be succeeded by a chant or a responsory, as it was called. So the idea of readings with musical response is a very ancient one, and I think was very successfully adapted into the format of our carol service here.
What was your own personal introduction to the festival, and what were your thoughts as you grew and grew with it?
I think I first was aware of it as a child. I myself was a boy chorister at Worcester Cathedral, and we sang Christmas services and carol services there, but I also became aware that there was this service being broadcast from King's College, Cambridge. There was an interest in it in Worcester because David Wilcox had been organist of Worcester before moving back to King's to become director of music. And so I do remember hearing it and knowing about it in my school years. I suppose little did I realize at that time that I would spend 37 years of my life directing the music myself.
And what has that 37 years meant? What do you feel you've brought and been able to experience as director of choirs and director of music?
Well, I've tried to maintain the quality of the singing and the nature of the service. The service itself has been largely untouched because, of course, the Christmas narrative remains the Christmas narrative. But I have tried to introduce perhaps a greater variety of carols into the service. And in particular, I have since 1983 commissioned a new carol each year. So my feeling about that is that I think it's a great and wonderful tradition to have inherited and to be responsible for. But at the same time, I wanted to make sure that it didn't become a fossilized tradition. And therefore, I wanted to introduce some new elements into it. But I hope it's recognizably the same thing that it was.
And in that time, have some of the commission works become, I guess for lack of a better term, have become breakout hits or pieces that have now entered the traditional repertoire?
Yes, I think they have. I would cite particularly two that we're doing this year, actually. No, we're not doing Illuminare Jerusalem of Judith Weir. We did that, I think, last year, but that's one of the early ones, which I think has become quite widely performed. This year we have another commission from Judith Weir. And there's John Rutter's What Sweeter Music, also, I think, has become quite a classic. But there are a number of them in that category, of which I might pick those two. Others have been perhaps a bit more esoteric and maybe haven't caught on so widely.
What are some of the other works that are on the program this year? What are some of the things that our listeners can look forward to?
Well, the criteria that I brought to bear on selection for this year was that I wanted to introduce, or rather to include, half a dozen or so pieces that we know were sung at the first carol service in 1918, as we have the records of that. And that will include Up Good Christian Folk and Listen, which was actually, I think, the first item in 1918. And Once in Royal David City, which ever since 1919 has been first, was actually not first in the first year, 1918. So I've included music that we know was done in 1918. I've also included compositions or arrangements by all those who have directed the choir during this last century. And I've included Silent Night, which we're going to sing in German, because that's exactly 200 years old this year, as is the authoress of the words of Once in Royal David City, Mrs. C.F. Alexander. So I've looked for a number of anniversaries and to enable people to get some idea of the history of the service by the repertoire that's included this year.
And looking back again at the history, I understand that the broadcasts continued even during World War II, when so much of the city was, when so much of England was facing some serious challenges. Why was that so important to keep that broadcast going?
Well, I, of course, wasn't around then. I was not born until 1948. But I would imagine that it's something about persistence in adversity. I think that if you look around the troubled spots in the world today, there are quite a lot of examples of where populations under stress actually struggle to survive and live as normal a daily life as they can. So I suspect there's something of that about it, you know, that we're not going to let us get this down. We're going to keep on doing this kind of attitude.
What symbolic importance has this added to King's College Cambridge's legacy, you know, being able to offer this, as you said, as a gift to now the world?
Well, I think we're very proud of that. I mean, it isn't the only thing we do, because we sing Evensong in the chapel regularly during term time. And King's is, of course, known for its academic achievements as well, which are, of course, central to its daily life. But there's no denying, I think, that the annual broadcast and the general publicity given to the carol service has been very especially associated with King's, and people quite often know King's for that reason.
And as you mentioned, this year the commissioned work was by Master of the Queen's Music, Judith Weir. Can you describe a little bit of what that piece is like?
Well, it's a setting of a poem by Charles Wesley, O Mercy Divine, and the majority of it is about the wise men, and it is written for choir and solo cello, and it has quite a striking cello part and quite a lot of lilting rhythms for the choir to sing, quite a lot of contrast between the high and low voices, and it's just generally beautifully inventive, as all Judith's music is.
And yeah, as you mentioned, that the festival is only one part of what the choir does. Can you tell us a little bit who is in the choir and what is its, what are some of the other things it does, and how does it involve the choristers in the spiritual and cultural life of the area?
Well, the choir consists of 16 choristers who are aged between about 9.5 and 13.5. We have some waiting in the wings as well, ready to take over as others leave and voices change. But on a daily basis, 16 of them sing. And we have 14 or so what we call choral scholars who sing the alto, tenor, and bass parts. And they are students in the college, mostly, one or two from other colleges. So they're following the undergraduate degree course. And that means that a particular characteristic of the choir is that the personnel changes over quite rapidly because the children are at school for a five-year period and the choral scholars mostly for a three-year period. So every year, about a third of the choir is new. So there's a constant process of reinvention, renewal on an annual basis, which I think is one of the challenges of the job I had, but also one of the positive features of it, because it's always coming up fresh.
And other than Evensong, are there other, what other types of performances?
Oh, well, we give quite a lot of concerts, both in the UK and abroad. For example, we're coming to the States at the end of March, early April. We're coming to the Twin Cities and to Washington, D.C. and New York City. And later in the year, we're going to Australia. We've just been in Holland and a bit before that in Poland. So we do quite a lot of concert touring. We also do broadcasting and we make CD recordings. The college now has its own recording label. So the recordings we make now are published on that label.
And as you mentioned before, with the internet now, there is virtually almost unimpeded access for people to...
Yes, and quite a new, it's interesting you mentioned that, because quite a new thing we've done for just a few years is to webcast Evensong. So each week we record all the Evensongs that we sing, and we generally send one out on the internet, one a week. So that means that people can listen. If they're on the west coast of America or New Zealand or somewhere, they can, as it were, be brought into the chapel for Evensong.
Mm.
And we've had a lot of appreciation of that.
Well, I was going to ask, now that a platform like the internet allows not only you to broadcast, but then people to respond, what are some of the things you hear back from the people who watch and listen and are inspired?
Well, I think very often people say, you know, I sure never be able to make the journey all the way to Cambridge to hear the choir in the chapel, so it's wonderful to be able to hear it in my own home. Others might say, well, they've been once or twice, but not very often, and it's nice to be reminded of it. So there's quite a wide range of response, but it's been very gratifying to learn how much people around the world have appreciated this innovation.
Mm. And what are some of the things you feel you've brought during your 37 years there? What have you tried to bring and instill?
I think I've tried to be a true servant of the liturgy in the chapel and the music that we sing. I've tried to present it in the best possible way on a sometimes almost daily basis. And so I hope that there's been a consistency of approach and that it's been one which has been concerned with raising people's spirits.
And what do you envision ahead as your successor moves forward and takes
well,
it to
I'm
the future?
Sure he'll, yes, I'm sure my successor will bring new and fresh ideas and that the choir will go from strength to strength. For me, I shall withdraw and hope to continue conducting and playing as and when people invite me to do so.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate it. And we certainly will be looking forward to broadcasting.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for your interest.
That was Stephen Cleberry, Director of Music at King's College Cambridge, who will conduct his 37th Festival of Lessons and Carols this Christmas Eve. The service will be broadcast via American Public Media at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. More information on the festival, including a PDF of the service program, can be found at kings.cam.ac.uk. As was mentioned in our conversation, various churches and schools have instituted their own versions of lessons and carols, including Westminster Choir College here in Princeton. Professor James Jordan, who is director of the Westminster Conducting Institute, first launched the service in 1992. He He said the high profile of the program at King's College, Cambridge, has served as an inspiration for others.
I think everybody who's a choral conductor, at least in my generation and maybe before me, was aware of, you know, the King's service and the lessons and carols. And I think before my time, but in the 60s, one of the big things that happened, I think, to kind of proliferate the knowledge of lessons and carols or readings and carols at King's was the publication of the Carols for Choirs book. When David Wilcox took over the King's College Choir, they had been singing unison carols, and he thought that was kind of boring, so he wrote some descants. And people went so crazy over them that Oxford University Press asked him to write carol arrangements, which have become the staple of the Cambridge lessons and carols, and in fact are used around the world. So I think it was a little bit of hearsay, but I think a lot of it was those carol arrangements, which drew attention to the tradition at King's.
And now there are certainly many institutions and churches that put on some form of lessons and carols. Where does that tradition date back to, and how much impact did King's College Cambridge have in widening that tradition and moving it forward?
Oh, it's been copied all around the world. I mean, the period. I mean, you know, the format with readings from the Bible and from Gospels seemed to resonate across all religious boundaries. And the idea that one would intersperse carols with readings of the season to give a beautiful view of the Christmas story, I think was very intoxicating to a lot of, not only churches, but church musicians around the world. And Lord knows we all want a Christmas program in our churches, and this seemed to be a natural fit around the world.
Well, Westminster certainly has cultivated its own very cherished tradition in its evenings of readings and carols. How have you adapted that format to make it your own at Westminster?
Oh, what a journey this has been. So this is year 26. I was on leave for one of those years on sabbatical. So this is actually year 25, even though it's gone on for 26 years. It started, Rachel, very innocently. I was a new faculty member at Westminster, and my charge was chapel choir. And so the first year I was there, we did our traditional, there was a Christmas at Westminster series where every choir sang a concert. And I thought, well, for freshmen, this may not be the best thing for 4 months into their academic life. And then I thought, well, let's do a lessons and carols. And I copied exactly the service. The readings were the same. Even I do believe, I'd have to look back, but the carols were identical to most of them. It started out with Once in Royal David City, you know, the standard carols and the readings. And we had readers, Joe Formerfelt read, Diana Crane read. But one of the changes we did make initially was Kathy Shaw and I inserted the bells. Now, I must give credit where credit's due. I started my teaching career at Lewisburg High School, Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And at Bucknell, William Payne, who's well known for his handbell compositions, conducted the chapel choir at Bucknell. And Bucknell had a tradition of lessons and carols in the King's tradition, exactly as it was. So for my years at Lewisburg High School, you know, everybody in town went to this, and it was a stunning affair. Bill, however, used handbells in his lessons and carols, and that included the ringing in of the season, where the pealing of the handbells around the chapel. So being that I had been exposed to that, the second year I was at Westminster when we started this, it was handbells, chapel choir, and we included the ringing in of the season, which I literally borrowed from Bucknell University. Then something interesting happened. That first year, it was a full house, as all of the Christmas concert at Westminster were. And the second year, I think it was Ann Sears who asked me, well, maybe we should go to two nights, because there were complaints that there weren't enough tickets. It sold out early. So we went to two nights, and the choir grew enormously that year, so we had to build all sorts of scaffolding up in the front. But we still kept the King service. And then the third year, I think it was my idea, we probably need to move it to Princeton Chapel because I really think we only want to do this one night. Well, people didn't think that we'd sell out the Princeton Chapel, and the long and short of the story is that the tickets literally went in a half hour. That was still a kind of King's format. What changed was, again, it was musically motivated. I wanted to not use Once in Rural David City, and so the piece that opens the Westminster readings and carols is the arrangement of I Wonder as I Wander by Steve Pilkington. That was my first commission. In later years, we changed some of the choral music. Mack Wilbur came and wrote carols for us. And then Joe Flummer felt, when it started to really grow, felt that there needed to be more people driving the sound of the carols in that big space. So we added symphonic choir. And then at that time, we started to think, mainly through conversations with Steve Pilkington, my colleague in sacred music, about making it more ecumenical, if that's an appropriate word, to not tie ourselves down to religious readings, but finding poetry and text to frame an evening with themes. So we morphed from a very somewhat rigid order of service to something that would be uniquely ours. So we obviously added I Wonder as I Wander. Several years after that, we added the processional by James Whitborn from the Missa Carolae, which is now a traditional opening for us. And we varied the readings. So the idea of music and readings is still intact and very influenced by the King's tradition. But as one of my British friends who attended last weekend's readings and carols said, my, it has certainly drifted quite a distance from the lesson we carols at King's. And it has. It's uniquely our own. And the other thing that came out of this, Rachel, that I think is so exciting is that it has become the concert for not only the community of Princeton to come to, but it is a time where Westminster sings together. And going through all of the transitions that we're going through, this particular one had particular import. It was important for as many of our students to sing together as possible during this time of year. So it has become a community event and a communal event for our musical community on campus, and we really love doing it. So there's pieces of the traditional all influenced by King, certainly.
That was Westminster Choir College professor James Jordan, who helped launch Westminster's Evening of Readings and Carols based on the King's College format in 1992. You can hear a rebroadcast of this year's Westminster performance Christmas Day at 3 p.m. More information on Westminster is available at rider.edu/WCC. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo that focus on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of WWFM and happy holidays. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.